is about 25 years after the establishment of the church. So in Acts chapter 2, you're at AD 33. Jesus died about 50 days before. And then the gospel has gone out from Jerusalem and then to Judea, then to Samaria, and then to other parts of the Roman Empire, even by the end of the book, to Rome itself, where Paul has carried the gospel. Here in Acts chapter 26, Paul has already been arrested. He has been in prison for 2 years, over 2 years. And he has been tried by the Roman governor Felix. And the Jews brought all kinds of accusations against Paul that they could not prove. And Felix should have let him go because he knew that he was innocent of the charges. But to show the Jews a pleasure, the Bible says, he kept him incarcerated. Finally, Felix moved from his position and he was replaced by Governor Festus in the latter part of Acts 24. And Festus also heard the accusations of the Jews against Paul. He also determined that Paul was not guilty of any breaking of any Roman laws, but he also was willing to please the Jews and keep Paul in prison. Now, as we go through this section, we're just going to do what I call an old-fashioned Bible class, just go through the text of the Scriptures and pull out the meaning and see the flow of the events that are going through, because this is a very important part of the history of the early church, because not only has the church been inserted into Jewish culture and into Palestine, where it had been prophesied it would begin, and where the people had been especially taught to expect the Messiah to come. But now the gospel is also going, as Jesus had instructed, to all the world. And in this case, the world included Rome, who was the ruling nation at the time, and they were in charge of the governing of all the world, and therefore the church soon found itself being scrutinized by the Roman government and having to deal with the laws that pagan society had. And eventually Rome figured out that Christianity was not just a part of Judaism, but it was a new religion. And the Jews made sure that the Romans, as far as their influence was able to do so, the Romans did not look favorably upon Christianity, but that they were accepting of Judaism. Generally speaking, the Romans would allow indigenous people to accept or to keep their own religions as long as it didn't interfere with the governing of the Romans. They would let them keep whatever religion they had. They did not really care that they kept the same religion of the Roman nation, the Roman gods, as long as it did not keep them from obeying the Romans and causing a tumult in the empire. But in this case, the Jews are making an issue out of Christianity. They've arrested Paul. They've tried to kill him on more than one occasion, but the Romans were very good rulers or governors as on the whole, and they had good laws and good administrators, and so they protected Paul even before they really understood what was going on. They rescued him, and then they protected him in their system so the Jews could not get to him. Now, here in Acts chapter 24, what I'd like to do is go through this first, the last part of 24, and then pretty rapidly through chapter 25, and then focus on chapter 26. So if you have a Bible, I encourage you to follow along with us. Notice in the end of 24, verse 27, "But after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's room, and Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul bound." This is the most inactive time in Paul's ministry as far as we can tell. During these 2 years, he did not write any books of Scripture. He did not get to do any preaching of the Word of God. He did not get to establish any congregations. I suppose that he was studying his Scriptures in the quiet of that Roman prison. Perhaps he was talking to the Roman guards who would come about the gospel, but there's nothing that we know of that we could put our finger on for sure that Paul did during this time, except for preach to Felix and Festus and King Agrippa, which were milestone moments, as we'll see later today, in the history of the church, especially when he preached to King Agrippa in chapter 26. Now we go into chapter 25. Festus comes into power. I'll just summarize the first few verses. As soon as he came into his position, his headquarters was in Caesarea. That's about 60 miles from Jerusalem. Jerusalem's built on a hill or a mountain, Mount Zion. And so he left Caesarea and went uphill 60 miles and met with the powers that be in Jerusalem. Just a courtesy call, it seems like. He's getting to see the lay of the land. He's learning the principal people that he's going to be working with as a governor. And among those would be the high priest and the Sanhedrin court. So he goes up to Jerusalem, and they haven't forgotten about Paul, even though they've, you know, he's been in prison for 2 years and he's not been able to cause them any problems. From their perspective, they still are angry with Paul. They hate him. They want him dead. And so they bring it up and they say, "What about Paul? He's, you know, send him back up here. Let us try him in our courts." Now, they wanted to kill him, of course, but that was the guys. Bring him up here and we'll try him. But the Roman governor was, and the laws that they had worked well for Paul. He said, "No, he'll be tried in Caesarea. That's my headquarters. He's in my court system. We're not turning him over to the Jews. But you can come up there and you can accuse him. And the Roman way is for him to be able to speak face to face with his accusers before the court. We do not kill anyone without them having an opportunity to defend themselves." And so he goes back after 10 days to Caesarea. The Jews follow him up there. And the next morning they have a court case. Paul is brought in. The Jews come in. They make all kind of accusations against Paul, which they could not prove. And Paul's allowed to speak for himself, which he does. You notice in verse 7, that's when they've made these great complaints against him. Verse 8, I'm in Acts 25, verse 8. "While he answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor yet against Caesar, have I offended anything at all." Paul says, "I'm innocent against crimes against Jewish law. I'm innocent against crimes against Roman law. And I am innocent against crimes of divine law." He said, "I haven't done anything to offend any of the authorities over me. I'm not guilty of sacrilege. I'm not guilty of heresy. And I'm not guilty of insubordination." Paul, and he was speaking truthfully. The gospel had not caused him to do any of those things. He was just trying to help people. He was not trying to lead any political movement against the Romans, or for that matter, against his own nation. Now you get down to verse 9, "But Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure." He's a politician. He understands that Paul is powerless. Christians don't have a lot of influence, as far as he knows. But he's going to have to work with the high priest. The leaders in Jerusalem are definitely going to be able to cause him problems if they don't like him. Incidentally, history says that he got along pretty well with the Jews. He was a stern man, and they did not want to cross him, but as long as they worked with him, they liked him pretty well. He was especially good at going out and ridding the land of the robbers that had infested the hills and roadsides, such as Jesus mentioned in the parable of the Good Samaritan. He would send his soldiers out and he would apprehend them. And so it made it safer to travel, and the Jews appreciated that. So he knows which side his bread's buttered on, and he's willing to show them a political favor by, at Paul's expense, he keeps him in prison, even though he really should have been released. Now, the latter part of verse 9, before we get to that keeping him in prison, he says to Paul, "Wilt thou go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me?" Now, he had figured out that Paul didn't want to be judged by the Jews in their courts. Perhaps he also had seen the nefarious intentions of the Jews against Paul, because he will say later in his conversations with King Agrippa that they wanted to kill him, so he knows that. At some point he knows that, probably by this time. And Paul says, "No, I don't want to go there. I stand at Caesar's judgment seat. That's where I ought to be. I am a Roman citizen. I refuse to go to Jerusalem. I appeal to Caesar." Now, in the Roman system, what we would say appealing to the high court or the Supreme Court was the equivalent, what he was doing here. If you did not get satisfaction at the lower court level, which would be at Festus's level, a defendant could say, well, I want to be heard by Caesar. And so Festus confers with his advisors and he says, you've appealed to Caesar, to Caesar you'll go. And so he leaves him in prison, but he's no longer, his case is no longer in his jurisdiction. It's been bounced up to the higher court. And that also took the Jews out of it. Now, when you get to the end of chapter 26, Paul would have been better off at that point if he had not appealed to Caesar, because King Agrippa, and fast-forwarding to the end of our studies, Agrippa says, we should let him go. There's nothing he's done that's wrong. But they could not let him go at that point because it was not in their jurisdiction to do so anymore. But in this case, when Paul said this, he had to make this move, because if they had sent him back to Jerusalem, they were lying in wait. They intended to kill him. And there would have never been a hearing before Agrippa in chapter 26. All right, that gets us down then to 25:13. Now remember, Festus is the new governor, and it was traditional for the other religious or the other political leaders to pay homage to him or to give him a courtesy call, and they have come to visit with him. Now, Agrippa is not a governor, he's a king, but in reality, there's not as much difference as that may sound to our ears, because he was a king, but not over a lot of property. And Festus was in Caesarea, so there was a lot of power invested in the governor in that situation. But the king also had a lot of authority, and they were going to be working side by side. For instance, Festus, even though his authority resided in Lebanon or in the northern part of Palestine, he had been granted rulership or administration over the temple, which was in Jerusalem, which was a part of the reign of Festus. So Festus was over the politics in the south, but because Agrippa had some experience among the Jews, he understood their laws better, he was given authority over the temple, which included, among other things, being able to appoint and demote the high priest. And he did that 7 times during his reign. The Jews hated that. They didn't think that a political leader ought to be able to tell them who their high priest was. But he was given that authority by the Caesar, and he used it. He also had control over the treasury of the temple, so he had the money of the purse strings, and he had control over the events, the administration of the temple. But for the most part, he let them do that, the day-to-day things on their own. So you have these two. Festus is the new governor. King Agrippa has been king for about 7 years at this point, so he has more experience, but he's much younger. He's only 30 years old, and Festus will be dead in just 2 years. So even though he's a new governor, he's a much older man. He has more experience in the world, may not have as much political experience, certainly not with the Jews, but he has a lot of savvy. He would have been a Roman soldier. He led men in battle, and so he was more of a rough-hewn guy. So if you're sort of beginning to learn these personalities, that's going to be important today as we go through our lessons. We're going to see how the gospel went to these different people and how the interplay of the personalities and the positions had a bearing on how the gospel was received. All right, that brings us then down to verse 14, when they had been there many days, that is, Agrippa and Bernice, his sister was traveling with him. Governor Festus brought up Paul to King Agrippa. And what he's trying to find out, as we'll see toward the end of this chapter, is I need to send him to Rome, but he was delaying that process because I don't know what to put on the accusation. I don't know how to fill out the paperwork. I can't send him up there without any accusation for them to determine whether he's guilty or not. But I can't put down there he's upset the Jews because of their superstitions, because the Romans don't make any judgments along those lines. And that's how he viewed what was going on. It's a question about their laws, and he seemed to be befuddled about it. And so he said, King Agrippa, since you know more about the Jews than I do, would you help me? Would you help determine what we should accuse him of in the Roman system, the Roman court? And there's a good deal to be learned from what... Now, this is a behind-the-scenes picture. And it shows the inspiration of the Scriptures for us, because what we're about to read was not public knowledge. It wasn't a preached sermon. Here you have two men who are not even Christians. They're pagans. And they're having a conversation behind closed doors, as it were. But we're going to read exactly what they said. How did Luke know that? Well, the Holy Spirit told him. And we also get some insights into these two men and their friendship and their, especially Festus's view of Christianity in what he said to Agrippa behind closed doors. So let's read this, beginning in 15, and about whom? Well, the last part of 14, there was a certain man left in bonds by Felix. So this is old business. It's not really my case. It's from the previous administration, but I've got to deal with it. 15, about whom, when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me, desiring to have judgment against him, to whom I answered, it is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die. See, he knew they wanted him to die. Before that, he which is accused, have the accusers face to face, have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. Therefore, when they were come hither, without any delay on the morrow, I sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought forth, against whom, when the accuser stood up... Now, you picture that? This is the first time Festus has met Paul, and the first time he's heard anything about this case except what the Jews have told him in Jerusalem. And he's thinking, well, this is going to be a normal court case. They're going to accuse him of wrongdoing, and I'm going to determine whether he's broken the law or not. But he said it wasn't like that. The last part of 18, they brought none accusation of such things as I supposed. It was the oddest case, he says. It wasn't like I was expecting. Now here, 19 is an important verse, and we're going to refer to it throughout the day. But had certain questions against him of their own superstition. Interesting choice of words. And of one Jesus, which was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. The book of Acts is sometimes called the Gospel of the Resurrection, because that's the primary emphasis in the book of Acts. It's about the resurrection. You know, we preach a lot on baptism from Acts, and that's one of the key doctrines there. But that's not the primary doctrine. I mean, that's how men and women came to Christ and how they were forgiven of their sins. But the thing that was being preached primarily in the book of Acts was that Jesus is alive. Now, in our culture, at least up to this point, because we have such a history in Christianity, at least in a general sense, we haven't had to emphasize the resurrection as much. I mean, I just grew up, and I guess all of us did, not even giving a second thought to the fact that a man could live after he was dead. I mean, Jesus was raised from the dead. Everybody believes that. Everybody knows that. That was more the attitude that we had or we heard, even from people who aren't members of the church. You know, nobody ever questioned, as far as I remember, you believe Jesus is alive? I mean, he was killed. He lived 2,000. No. The resurrection has been taught and believed, generally speaking. But put yourself back in that Roman culture that had not had the time for the gospel message to get out, and they went around preaching that they should obey Jesus, that they should follow Jesus, they should be Christians. Now, who's Jesus? Well, he was a man in Jerusalem, but they crucified him. He's dead? Well, no, he's not dead anymore, because he came back. He came back from the dead. Are you kidding me? That was the attitude of the Romans. So that's why they emphasized the resurrection so much. Jesus came back. He is not dead. He's alive. Now, Festus, he doesn't believe that. He says, that sounds like a myth to me. That sounds like superstition. Is that a legend? What are you arguing about? Why are you spending time thinking about, you know, Paul says this guy's alive. Did you say he's dead? And What does that matter? That's the attitude of this governor, Festus. And now he's giving that report to Agrippa in hoping that he will help him determine the accusation against him. And 20, and because I doubted of such manner of questions, I asked him whether he would go to Jerusalem and there be judged of these matters. But when Paul had appealed to be reserved unto the hearing of Augustus, I commanded him to be kept, that I might send him to Caesar. So he's caught him up to the present time. That's the story, the backstory of why Paul's in my prison system and what I think about it, what I know. And he says, will you help me? And so Agrippa says, I'll hear him. I'll hear the case. That's in verse 22. I also will hear the man myself tomorrow. Thou shalt hear him. So Paul, meanwhile, back in the prison cell, not knowing any of this is going on, a guard comes to him and says, you're going to be brought up tomorrow before the court. King Agrippa's in town. He's going to hear your case. That probably did not thrill Paul to hear that Agrippa is going to hear his case. Because Agrippa was a Herod. He was the last of seven Herodian kings. He doesn't have any children, as far as we know, and no one replaced him when he died. So he's the last in that line. But if you wanted to go back in his history a little bit, up his family tree, you know what you'd find? His great-grandfather was Herod the Great. Does that ring any bells? Matthew chapter 2, there's a baby born in Bethlehem, and Herod was told by the Magi, the wise men, a king is born. Come back and tell me where he is that I can worship him too. Didn't want to worship him. What did he want to do? He wanted to kill him. And then when he found out that they didn't come back and tell him, he killed all those babies. That's this man's great-grandfather. His great-uncle was Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas killed John the Baptist. Beheaded him. Also, wanting to destroy Jesus, Luke 13, go tell that fox, you remember that passage? And then it was this man's great uncle, Antipas, that Jesus was brought before when he was being tried and Pilate was trying to figure out a way to get out of this sticky situation. He heard Herod was in town and sent him across town. Let Herod judge him since he's from Galilee. And Herod put a purple robe on him and mocked him. Sent him back. Well, that was his great uncle. Then his dad, King Herod Agrippa II, who is the Agrippa we're talking about here, his dad was King Herod Agrippa I. He only had one son and he had three daughters. So he became, this man became a king after his father. Now you will remember that King Herod Agrippa from Acts chapter 12. He's the one who killed James with a sword and put Peter in prison. And then later in that chapter, he took the glory that belonged to God. You remember the judgment against him? He was eaten of worms and he died. That was his dad. That was when this Herod was 17 years old. He wasn't in Palestine at the time. He was being trained in the court of Emperor Claudius in Rome at that point. Emperor Claudius really liked him, and he wanted to make him a king at 17 to take his dad's place, but his advisors ruled against it or encouraged him not to. And so he delayed and did not make him a king at that point, but he continued to ramp up his training, and then at age 23, he became a king. That would have been about, he was born about 27, about 44 is when his dad was eaten of worms and died. Probably about 49 or 50, AD 49 or 50, he becomes king of a little area up in northern Palestine. Later, when Nero took over for Claudius, he extended his reign and gave him more cities, more territory, including the temple area that we talked about earlier. Now, all that, Paul hears that Agrippa wants to try your case. That can't be good. I mean, they've killed the babies. They killed John the Baptist. They killed James. They put Peter in prison. They mocked Jesus. it's not going to be a good day. But he didn't have any choice, and so he comes before him. Now, it is going to turn out better than that, but that would have been the immediate reaction probably to a Christian who heard that Herod Agrippa was in town. That's not going to be good for us. So he says, I'll hear him. They go and tell Paul. They bring him in. In verse 23, and on the morrow when Agrippa was come, and Bernice, that's his sister, we'll talk more about her later, with great pomp. So picture this scene if you can. You have Governor Festus maybe wearing his, you know, regal robes. You have the king comes in, maybe he's wearing purple, a crown on his head, Bernice at his side in full regalia. All the centurions are there, the military leaders. There would have been five probably posted at Caesarea at this time, a centurion's over 1,000 men. So these are high-ranking military officers. And all the principal men of the city are there. So it's quite an array or an audience of people who've met. And the most important ones I picture up on the stage, you know, there's the king in the middle and the governor on one side, Bernice on the other side. Maybe further out the centurion, certainly on the first row, principal men of the city. And they bring in Paul. Chapter 26 says that he's in chains. It doesn't mention that here. So he's walking in with chains on his hands, maybe on his feet. Maybe they've cleaned him up some, maybe allowed him to cut his hair or shave his beard since they knew about it the day before. Maybe take a bath. Maybe got some new clothes on. We don't know that, but it seems that they probably wouldn't have wanted a prisoner coming in smelling as prisoners would have smelled and looking like he would have looked. But anyway, they bring him in, and here this prisoner in chains is in front of this great august audience of people. But Paul was not intimidated. Paul is going to say exactly what needs to be said on the occasion. Of course, he's guided by the Holy Spirit, and it's recorded for us perfectly by the Spirit. That's chapter 26, now verse 1. Then Agrippa said unto Paul, thou art permitted to speak for thyself. You don't have a lawyer? You're your own lawyer. And Paul's well qualified academically and by his experience to do this. Plus, he's guided by the Spirit, so he's happy to speak for himself. And he says as much. He stretched forth his hand, answered him, I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because I answer for myself this day before thee, touching all the things whereof I'm accused of the Jews. So I'm glad to have an opportunity to give my side of this. And then Paul goes into his history. He compliments him in verse 3 as being an expert in Jewish matters. Not only was he over the temple, which would have made him acquainted with the law and with the practice of the Jews, but also he is a Jew himself. The Herods were Idumeans, they were from Edom. But his mother, history says, was very interested in the Jewish religion and practiced it. His father, not so much. He was not a moral man. But his mother, it's thought, taught King Herod Agrippa II, this man, the law, and was interested in him following after the religion of the Jews. And Paul compliments and says, I know you know what I'm about to say because you're an expert in the law. So that would help Paul to have somebody in the Roman system who didn't just look, you know, like a rabbit in the headlights look when he started talking about the law, because Festus didn't understand any of it, but Agrippa would. And so he goes into this and says, I grew up a Jew, verse 4. I kept the law perfectly as I could. I was a Pharisee, and these other accusers in here could tell you that if they would. Now they wouldn't, but he said they know it. And he said, but things changed for me. And start reading in verse 5, which knew me from the beginning, if they would testify, that after the most straitest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. He said, I was very conservative. And I kept the law with rigor. I was a strict follower of the law, more strict than the law itself required, a Pharisee, because they had added a lot of traditions too. And verse 6, and now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers. He said, I'm not doing something new. This is exactly where the law was pointing us. This was exactly the fulfillment of the promises that God had made in the Old Testament for the Jews, unto which promise our 12 tribes instantly serving God day and night hope to come. He said, I'm here because of the resurrection of the dead. That was the point of the Jewish law, that this world is not all there is, that there is a heaven afterward. And that Jesus was going to come and save people so they could go to heaven. He said, that was the point of the old law. I'm following through with what the old law prophecies were about. For which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews. Why should it be thought a thing incredible with you that God should raise the dead? If God is God, is it hard for Him to raise somebody from the dead? I mean, if He could make a world, could He raise the dead? If He could make somebody alive, could He make them alive again? If His own Son were killed, is it not possible that He would raise Him on the third day, Paul says? Why is that an incredible thought? Why would that be hard? Verse 9, I verily thought with myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. That's an understatement, isn't it? Boy, what did He do to the church, to the Christians? Acts chapter 9. Well, He's going to go into some of the things He did. In fact, you get more detail in this speech than you do in the earlier speeches and history. Read this with me carefully and see which thing I also did in Jerusalem. So that was the headquarters of the Pharisees. And many. I've underlined that word in my Bible just to remind me. You know, we know about Stephen, but how many other Stephens were there that were put in prison? Did I shut up in prison? Having received authority from the chief priest, he was like their hitman. The high priest, boy, who are we going to get to persecute the Christians? That young Saul, he's a go-getter, I tell you. Let's see if he'll do it. And boy, he was sitting on ready. Whenever he got the authority, he acted with energy to carry it out. I gave my voice against them when they were put to death. Not just one, they, plural, were put to death. How many others had died in that early persecution? We don't know. And I punished them oft. I've underlined that word oft. In every synagogue. There was only one temple, but there were a lot of synagogues. In one city, you would have a number of different synagogues. It's sort of like congregations. You know, you have, maybe if you have enough population, you may have a congregation on one side of town, the other side of town. The rule for a synagogue was you had to have 10 families to start one. So if you had 10 families in this community, they could start a synagogue, a place of worship. And then it might be, you know, over on another street, there'd be another one and so forth. But Paul went from synagogue to synagogue to synagogue, finding the Christians, because early on, the Christians used the same buildings. They had grown up going to those buildings to worship God. And even though they didn't worship according to the law, they could worship God in the same building according to the New Testament. So he would go and find them and punish them. He compelled them to blaspheme. Well, how do you get somebody to blaspheme? Or maybe you ask them, but if that doesn't work, you threaten them or you physically abuse them. Paul did all three. Being exceedingly mad against them. No Christian, as far as I know, had ever hurt Paul or Saul at this point. But his zeal for false religion was so strong that it caused him to hate those with whom he disagreed. I think you see that in cultures, all the cultures. But you're seeing it more and more here. People are blowing up church buildings, going in with guns and kill. They may not know a single person in that place, but they just hate religion. They just hate Christianity. And so far they haven't differentiated between New Testament Christianity, denominational Christianity, Protestant Christianity, Catholic Christianity. They just see religion or Christianity in a general sense. But eventually they will probably figure out the different, just like with the Jews and Christianity, eventually they figured out the difference. Even at estranged cities, not just one city, Damascus. He had done that before Damascus. So you see, he's giving a history of himself because it is the history of Christianity that he's telling Agrippa. The church was growing and I was hurting it. I tried to put it out of business. Well, that might have rung a bell with Agrippa. He said, hey, wait a minute, I've got a lot in common with him. I mean, he's just like my granddaddy. He's just like my daddy. He hated the Christians. So there would be that, you know, starting at point A to come to point B, he's going back and found the common ground with him to help to lead him through the thought processes that changed Paul's life so that it could also perhaps change Agrippa's life. So, and then he tells about his vision on the road to Damascus, verse 13, around midday, bright light, brighter than the sun, fell to the earth, heard Jesus speak to him, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? Verse 14, I said, who art thou, Lord? I'm Jesus. Verse 15, and then he gives him his commission. This is what I want you to do. Verse 16, but rise and stand upon thy feet. I have appeared to thee for this purpose. This is not random. It's not just to stop you persecuting my people. No, I have a bigger purpose in mind today, and to make thee a minister and a witness both of these things which thou hast seen up to the point, that's what he had told Agrippa, what he had had personal experience in, what he had seen up to this point when he had seen the vision. That was personal with him. But there would be more than that. And of those things in which I will appear unto thee, I'm going to tell you other things to teach. Delivering thee from the people, that is, your own Jewish nation is going to persecute you, but I will deliver you. And we just saw that in the history, in this history from chapter 24 forward. And from the Gentiles, Paul was speaking to, you know, a court of the Gentiles, unto whom now I send thee, to open their eyes, to turn them from darkness to light, and from the power of Satan unto God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins, and inheritance among all them which are sanctified by faith that is in me. I want the Gentiles to be saved just like I want the Jews to be saved, and you're going to be an instrument, Paul, to that end. I want you to turn them out of their darkness. Well, paganism was darkness. The different gods they worshipped of lust and hate and war, the way they interacted morally in the Roman Empire was atrocious. Women married to divorce and divorced to marry. I mean, it was just constant change. They aborted their babies with impunction. If they brought them to term, they'd just leave them out on the streets, exposed to die or be taken by someone. It was an awful culture. It was a lot of darkness. So the gospel going into it elevated it. And once they changed the hearts of the citizens, enough of them, then it changed the Roman Empire. And if you know history, you know that by AD 313 and following, the Edict of Milan made Christianity legal. Constantine converted to Christianity. And so the Roman Empire became a Christian nation at that point. Now, not strictly speaking, he wasn't baptized till years later near his death. And so it was a political move, but it had finally become acceptable in the Roman Empire. Christianity had changed enough people that it became politically helpful to the Caesar to say that's our official religion. All right, I think that's a good place for us to draw a line for the class, and we'll pick up there in our worship hour and talk about the non-conversion of King Agrippa. Not every sermon ended with a response when Paul preached either. In this case, he's not going to have success in converting Agrippa, but he is going to have success in some other purposes, and certainly helps us to understand why Paul said what he said and how it was received and what lessons we learned from that. I appreciate your attention, your attendance.